If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 524, Big Data, Little Privacy. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Monday, April 23rd, 2018. In this episode of the podcast, I will share a conversation that happened just yesterday on Sea Realm Radio with author BJ Mendelsohn. He has written a number of books on the topic of big data, the internet, social media, privacy, that sort of thing. And as I will say late in the interview, I think all of this comes down to, or at least falls under the general umbrella of, worldview management. And specifically, the use of technology to manage people's visions of reality. I'm not going to say a whole lot to introduce the conversation because, well, BJ does a pretty good job of representing himself. And the titles of his books, I think, speak volumes. His most recent book, at least the audiobook version that I took in, is The End of Privacy. But before that, he wrote a book called Social Media is Bullshit. And if you've been listening to the Sea Realm podcast, you know that that is an opinion that has been growing on me for quite some time. But before we get started, I want to extend my thanks to James S., who has a check sent every month to support my work, and Gary S., different S., who made a sizable donation via PayPal at just the right moment. I have several automatic payments that go out near the end of the month, and I wasn't watching my PayPal balance very closely, and just as it was about to crash into zero, Gary S. made that sizable donation and basically pulled my fat from the fire, or at least saved me an overdraft fee or whatever it is that PayPal does when you go below zero balance. All right, here is my conversation with BJ Mendelsohn, recorded just yesterday at WOOL-FM in Bellows Falls, Vermont.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right. My pleasure. All righty. So you are the author of a couple of books, and I'm just going to go ahead and stake a little claim right here, and I'm going to say that as long as you're not talking about excrement, but in fact you're talking about the sort of thing that comes out of the mouth of the president, it is okay to say the word bullshit on the radio. And I'm going to read just a little bit from the Wikipedia article on bullshit. Bullshit, also bull crap, is a common English expletive, which may be shortened to the euphemism bull or the initialism BS. In British English, bullocks is a comparable expletive. It is mostly a slang profanity term meaning nonsense, especially as a rebuke in response to communication or actions viewed as deceptive, misleading, disingenuous, unfair, or false. As with many expletives, the term can be used as an interjection, or as many other parts of speech. It can also carry a wide variety of meanings. A person who communicates nonsense on a given subject may be referred to as a bullshit artist. And I say all that because you are the author of a book called Social Media is Bullshit, which I agree with, although maybe our opinions are not entirely overlapping. What do you mean when you say social media is bullshit?
I think it comes down to that the technology might be great, but it doesn't work in the way it's often portrayed. And so that's what the book kind of set out to do and said, look, you know, we have, they're a little quieter now in 2018, but back when the book was written, we had all of those social media hucksters writing books and selling expensive courses and packages about how you can use Facebook to grow your small business. And the book was meant to say, look, it doesn't work that way. In fact, if you are a small business, you're probably going to waste a lot of money on Facebook, if anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're a small business, it's location, 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 really.
Right. That's right. And I think that a lot of that stuff gets lost. I mean, today we put so much emphasis on what happens on the internet, what happens on these different platforms, that we don't really stop and focus on the stuff that matters, which are all the things offline.
You contacted me via Twitter, and you mentioned that you had listened to an episode of the Sea Realm podcast, and I'm not all that good with Twitter. In fact, I have trouble figuring out what threads comments are parts of and finding things that I read in the past. I don't actually know which episode you listened to, but you you probably heard me grousing about Facebook. Is that right?
That's correct. I listened to quite a few of them. I do a lot of research before I pitch shows because I try to be selective as to where I want to appear. So I just enjoy your take on things.
So you probably know, thank you for that, by the way, you probably know that I think that to a large degree, Facebook is driving us insane. I think it is, is pushing people to be far more ideologically strident than they would be were they not spending a lot of their time defining themselves and asserting their identity by being angry at people who share a different identity and basically deciding that everything that the other camp has to say is bullshit. And that I have to, you know, I have to refute it in the most aggressive terms possible. And I think that that has a lot to do with the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. And I have so very little patience for this this Russia mania. And I'm really irritated that the whole Cambridge Analytica story didn't find any legs until there was a Russian name to attach to it. Because I was trying to get people interested in that dynamic a while ago, and there's just not many people interested. But this is something from your book, and you sent me your new book, which is, what is the new book?
Privacy and How We Get It Back. So there's no swear words in this one. I learned my lesson from the first time around, but it's Privacy, and people can find it at yourprivacybook.com.
Okay, that's not the one I heard. The one I heard was The End of Privacy.
Yes.
There were some swear words. What's that?
Yeah. So the audiobook has a different title. What we decided to do was, because of the nature of how people cover privacy, we wanted like a professional buttoned-down version. So that was the print book. The print was Privacy and How We Get It Back, and that's what we sent to journalists. And then if you read Social Media's Bullshit, you know that I like to make a lot of jokes. I like to have a lot of fun while I'm explaining topics. And so the audiobook, we gave a different title. It's The End of Privacy. And that's where we have all the jokes that are, you know, it's my preferred version of the book.
And the narrator, I don't recall his name, but I've heard him narrate other books. He's like one of those star narrators, I think.
Yeah. So last year, he was the voice behind a top nonfiction selling book, which was The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F. So that's where most people will recognize Mr. Roger Wayne from. But he's done quite a few others, and with luck, I hope to be working with him again.
Right on. Well, say a little bit about the motivation for writing about privacy and also social media.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with the Cambridge Analytica thing. I really couldn't have said it any better, that the media would not talk about what was going on, even though we were very much aware of what Robert Mercer was doing and the money that he was funneling in, and some of the outrageous claims that Cambridge Analytica was making. Anytime that you try to approach, and again, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm criticizing them because it's not meant to be, but you know, I've worked as an editor for CBS College Sports. I've worked as an editor for a fleet of tech and science sites over at Wonder How To. So I understand very well the pressure and other things that our friends in the media have to work with. But when you approach them about something like privacy or about what was going on with Cambridge Analytica, the response is usually, I don't have time to boil that down for my audience to understand. You know, if it's not sexy enough, it's not going to get page views. My boss will fire me if I don't get, you know, 30,000 page views on this post about cats. So that's really what drove the privacy book, was just how do I explain what's happening in a funny and simple way so that my dad gets it, my grandparents were still alive, that they would get it, that my cat could get it. So, and that was true with the social media book as well, where a lot of people didn't understand that when we see these gold rush things, which is what we see right now, Bitcoin and blockchain, the people that get rich aren't the people searching for gold, it's the people selling the shovels. And so it was those two things that really drove me to write these books.
You mentioned, and you've mentioned several times in the audiobook, that we tend to think of the internet and algorithms and big data as being magic. And right. I think Arthur C. Clarke famously quipped that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And I think for a lot of people, the technology doesn't have to be all that sophisticated, really. That if it's beyond our ability to grasp just easily and intuitively, then we don't worry about it and we just treat it like magic.
Right? And that's a problem, because when you look at something like Facebook, where, you know, just this week, they found a loophole within the GDPR rules over in the European Union so that they wouldn't have to follow it. And so when you have these companies that pretend, oh, you know, your newsfeed is this sacred, magical thing, and you don't need to know how it works, it just presents you fun pictures of babies, you know, we don't stop and wonder about, okay, well, why am I seeing a picture of that baby? I think that baby's really ugly. You know, we don't stop and question the platforms that we use. And so part of that is deliberate on the part of tech companies, where they don't want you to understand it, because if you do, you realize that if you have, let's say, like 700,000 Twitter followers, that number is meaningless. You know, they don't want you to know that, because then advertisers aren't going to give them their money. And the whole thing is based on trying to obscure the reality so that they can continue bilking advertisers out of billions of dollars.
That number of Twitter followers, 700,000, you didn't just pull that out of the air. That's not completely arbitrary, right?
That's right. That's my follower count. It was up to 1 million at one point. You know, I've been on Twitter for about a decade now, and so it's a little bit of a long story, but let me set it up real quick. Twitter, I've been there since about 2008, and they used to profile different accounts because they wanted people to be active when they came in. So they invented what was called the suggestive user list, and it was like 28 celebrities, and then you get to the very bottom of the list, and there was my dumb face. And they made it so that you had to automatically follow all of these people when you signed up for Twitter. So that's where most of my followers came from. I've tried over the years to chase a lot of them away, but in doing the research for Social Media Bullshit, I found that regardless of how many followers you have, the click-through rate, if you're lucky if it's 1%. You know, and that's true for celebrities, and it's true for people like me that have a lot of followers. So the number of followers Twitter wants you to think that matters, but the reality is that it doesn't. You know, those people, the famous example I always give in my presentations is I ask people, you know, how much money do you think my Twitter followers donated when I was raising money for a breast cancer not-for-profit? And this is when I was closer to 1 million followers. And the answer is a dollar. And then I tell people, okay, well, let's try this again. Some years later, Social Media's Bullshit came out. How many copies do you think I sold of the 7,000 or so copies of the book that were eventually sold? How many do you think were sold through Twitter? And usually people will be like 1,000 or 2,000. I tell them, no, it was 28. Most of my book sales came from me actually going out and going to bookstores and going on radio shows such as yourself. And so that's why I kind of said earlier, the offline stuff matters more than the online, because in order for the online platforms to be successful, they have to obscure this reality from everyone and make us think it's magic.
So that's another big theme of the book, is that all this money that's being made online with advertising is kind of a fraud in one respect, and that the this ability to identify people and their interests and target ads to them that are, you know, laser focused on their particular interests, it doesn't really actually cash out to a whole lot of increased sales for your product.
That's right. What I tell people is that 99.9% of the time, digital advertising doesn't work. You know, there is, to be fair, that 0.1% of the time where you might run the right Facebook campaign at the right time and get the right people. That does happen. I don't want to sound like I'm dismissing it completely, but more often than not, you get fake traffic that's usually generated by bots or generated by people in Bangalore who are working on a click farm. So, you know, there's that aspect where there's a lot of fraud going on, because most of the traffic on the web is, in fact, fake traffic, about 60% of it, if not more, and a lot of people don't realize that. So when we talk about all these clicks that you might get from Twitter or Facebook or any other platforms, you really do have to question how many of them are real. And then there's the other side of it, where the data, and what I tell people is that big data is really stupid, because it only knows what you tell it. So if I like something that's, like, let's say NPR related, but I'm not an NPR listener, as far as Facebook is concerned, if someone runs a campaign targeting NPR listeners, it's going to target me too, because of some random interaction I had maybe back in 2006 with something that was affiliated with NPR. So not only are you getting fake traffic, but a lot of traffic that is being generated, sometimes it's being, you know, these ads are being targeted at people who don't necessarily care or are even being accurately targeted.
You know, sometimes it goes the other way, though. Sometimes the ads are so spookily accurate that it kind of freaks you out. Like,
so,
go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm glad you mentioned that. So there's this thing, it's a little bit of a meme, where Everyone is saying that Facebook listens to them. And so the official response from Facebook is that they don't, but they do have the technology to do so. So I don't want to put on my tinfoil hat here, but I do think it's certainly within the realm of possibility that Facebook, while they may not be listening to you, your other apps are, and that data is often sold to Facebook. And so regardless of who is listening, someone is listening. And so, a lot of people report that kind of thing happening where they're talking about gardening tools, and they've never talked about gardening tools before in their life, and all of a sudden they open up Facebook and there's an ad for gardening tools. I mean, that's sort of the world that we live in.
There was an episode of the Reply All podcast where they really dug into that. And I'm fairly convinced by their debunking of it, just in that, you know, we're creating all this data all the time, right, which doesn't require a whole lot of bandwidth, whereas spying on somebody by using the microphone in their smartphone requires an enormous amount of bandwidth.
Right.
So there are easier ways for Facebook and Google and the NSA to track you than to actually listen to everything that you say in the proximity of your phone.
That's right. I mean, your phone is the world's greatest tracking device. And
you pay to carry it around.
Exactly. You know, I heard something great. It was from years ago on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, where he's going off on this rant, and he points out that Big Brother is here, but Big Brother is us. And I feel like that to me is sort of a perfect analogy of, you know, 80% of, or 85% of people my age, I'm going to turn 35 this week, have a smartphone. So you have an overwhelming majority of people my age are walking around with these portable recording devices that are constantly collecting information. So between your smartphones and then smart sensors and cameras and everything else that's out there today, we are completely surveilled. So it's very easy to get these targeted ads, which may or may not prove to be effective.
For a time, there were ads for some smoking cessation product following me around online. And I don't smoke, so I'm curious as to how that came about. I mean, that was a total miss. But now, these days, every time I open a web browser, somebody is pimping puppies.
Right.
Google knows that I love dogs, but it probably also knows that I'm not in a position to have one right now. But it doesn't matter. They're going to sell my love of dogs to advertisers. So I know where all the breeders of standard poodles and Bernedoodle puppies are in the New England area.
And that's the crazy thing to me. I mentioned the example in the book of washing machines where, you know, you might be at your grandmother's house looking up a new washing machine that you want to buy her. And then from that point on, no matter where you go in the world, you're going to get ads served up saying, hey, do you want to buy this washing machine? And so to me, you know, 19% of America's GDP is tied up in the advertising business. And so it's sort of mind-boggling when you think of the billions of dollars that just gets flushed down the toilet. And the only reason why it does get flushed down the toilet is because the people that are making the purchases don't understand. They think it's magic.
So say more about confusing technology with magic and what results from that. I mean, why is that such a big problem?
Sure. I think that, well, I'll give you an example of how easy it is to manipulate some of the technology. So Google News sends a huge amount of traffic to news sites anywhere in the world. So if you are a news site, you desperately want to get indexed by Google News. And so Google puts on this whole performance telling you how sophisticated their system is and how wonderful it is for surfacing things. But the truth of the matter is it's actually a really dumb system where if you continue to use the same words over and over again in the headline and in the content, and it's just basic SEO 101. You can easily manipulate Google to the point where if someone were to search Google News for, like, massive failure, you would have the top search result. And that's actually something that happened under the Bush administration where it was called a Google bomb, and people kept typing in massive failure and clicking on the White House. And so after a while, when you searched massive failure, the first search result that came up was George W. Bush's White House. And so it's very easy to manipulate these systems. But they don't, because if these things are sophisticated, they won't work. And I think that's the important thing for people to realize. I don't want anyone listening to be like, oh, well, you know, BJ's just dismissing these things as dumb. If these systems were sophisticated, you wouldn't be able to use them as fast as we use them. You know, like if Google had to stop and actually think and process the way that we think that it would, you'd be sitting there for a good couple of minutes. before you got your search results. So that's the kind of thing that we're dealing with, where we tell people these things are magic, but the algorithms are very dumb and simplistic, and with just a little bit of pushing can be manipulated. And so not telling people that and running around telling people, oh, well, we've got the smartest system in the world, is enough to get advertisers to put money into it. You know, the advertisers aren't going to stop and think about it, because in the advertising industry, there's a lot of corporate consolidation. So you have WPP, which is the world's largest advertising company, and they have Facebook and Google employees embedded right within WPP. So all that it takes is for them to go to the client and say, we think you should put money into Facebook because Facebook is magic. And the clients could go, well, of course I'm going to put that money into it. And you know, they're not going to stop and go, well, how is Facebook targeting me, and where is this data coming from, and is the algorithm correct? Another fun example for people at home, you can all play this. If you type congratulations or happy birthday into a Facebook status update, everyone is going to see it. Whereas if you post a link to something you want to promote, no one's going to see it. And that's something everyone listening can go and test out.
Well, anybody who has an online comic strip or a podcast they want to promote knows just how painfully true that is.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm going through it right now. I'm also a comic book writer. The book is called Vengeance Nevada. And, the thing that really drives me up a wall is that Sheryl Sandberg, about 10 years ago, was traveling the country and traveling the world and telling everyone, all you need is a Facebook page and you can make all these things happen. Like, if you're a small business, I'm paraphrasing here, but the quote is something along the lines of, if you're a small business, it makes no sense to not be on Facebook. And so a lot of comic creators also, you know, they heard that advice, because there's not necessarily a lot of great marketing advice in the comics industry, I found. And so everyone sort of followed that, where they were like, oh, okay, well, I need a Facebook page. And then what happened? You know, if you post something on Facebook, no one sees it unless you pay. And as the years have gone on, they've made it more and more expensive to reach fewer and fewer people. So to me, that's the maddening thing, is that we tell people, use social media and you can reach your audience. And it doesn't matter what platform we're talking about. Twitter does the same thing. Twitter doesn't want to tell people that, but they also have an algorithmic timeline where they sort of determine what you see and what you don't see. And so it's very hard these days for a creator to have any sort of audience, which is why I now give out my cell phone number. I know that's a little crazy, but I just tell people to call me or text me if they want to find out what I'm up to and what I'm working on, or I tell them to send me an email, because those are things I can control, whereas Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, I don't control what people see and what they don't see.
You talk in the book about how we as a population, you know, citizens of the United States, a fairly short memory. So that the government is really always working with private business to collect information on the citizenry. And every now and again, they go a little too far, they raise our ire, and we make a stink about it, and they back off for a little while until we forget, and then they get back to it.
Right.
I remember 2011, the Arab Spring, when, you know, there were the demonstrations in Tahrir Square, and Twitter and Facebook were basically claiming that they were bringing democracy to the world because, you know, yep, the demonstrators were using these tools to stand up to an oppressive government. Well, now, what is it, 6 years later, 7 years later, there's a military dictatorship in Egypt. A fallout from the Arab Spring was that the monarchy in Syria really cracked down on their demonstrators, and that was really the beginning of the ongoing Syrian conflict, which is dominating headlines today. And you don't hear Twitter executives and Facebook executives standing up now and saying, yes, yes, we were integral to the start of this you know, chain of events. Memories are short.
Yes.
And the people who manipulate us via this technology and the ability to collate and correlate enormous amounts of data are very aware of just how short our attention spans are, and how far they need to back off or behave themselves, and for just how long to get us to look at something shiny and not worry too much anymore about what's being done with our data and our privacy.
Like, I tell you, I talk about the Arab Spring in social media as bullshit, and there's a few points that just drive me up a wall about it. The first is that there was a guy named Wa'il Ghonam, and I don't know if anyone remembers him, but He was the Google executive that got jailed, and then he came out of jail, and you know, people were saying he was the face of the protests, and one day he's out there shouting to everyone, Egypt above all, and then the next day, literally within like 24 hours, he's on CNN stateside talking about how he's going to write a book about Twitter. And the kicker to that is that the people on the ground will tell you that they weren't using social media because social media was easily policed by the government. You know, they were actually using SMS, and in some cases, they were handing out leaflets. The problem was is that we had at the time, you know, thankfully, a lot of these people have faded into obscurity, but at the time you had like Jeff Jarvis and Clay Shirky and Gary Vaynerchuk and Seth Godin. You had like this cluster of internet personalities that were talking about how amazing and radical and world-changing this technology is, and they were all over the news because that was the narrative that we wanted to peddle. So you also had that narrative of the thing in Benghazi being caused by a YouTube video, which was peddled for a long time, which is again, which was not true. We found out years later. There was a lot of things that came out of the Arab Spring that, at the time, we were so convinced that it was social media that was driving this stuff. And to me, it's a little frustrating today. Now, you know, now that we're a little wiser, but at the same time, the people, the media. Again, I'm not criticizing the media, but there are a lot of journalists who were present for what happened almost 10 years ago. And are present today to report on things like Facebook and Cambridge Analytica. And even today, like, I have to bang on the door just to get them to look at what I'm talking about. Like, they want to talk to other journalists. They want to talk to other academics. They don't want to look backwards and say, well, I was wrong. You know, they want to just keep pushing the narrative that they're pushing. And so, yeah, the Arab Spring was a great example of that. ISIS is a very effective promoter of social media and using that to their advantage. We saw it in 2016. You know, the Russians, I don't think they had much of an impact, but they were utilizing social media. So we've seen that these tools have been overblown in their impact, and then we have seen some cases where they're effective, but we're not told that whole story. We're just told, hey, you remember the Iranian Revolution in 2009 where everyone on Twitter turned their avatar green? This is a true story, and they thought that that was going to change things in Iran forever. And here we are looking at maybe another conflict with Iran in the not-too-distant future.
Green avatars and everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real thing. It sounds absolutely ridiculous to say it in 2018, but in 2009, that was a real thing that happened on Twitter where everyone was making their avatar green because they thought for sure that's what was going to change Iran forever.
You're listening to WOOL Black Sheep Radio on 91.5 FM, Sea Realm Radio with KMO.
Hey, I'm KMO. You are listening to Sea Realm Radio, and I'm talking with BJ Mendelson, who is the author of multiple books on the topics of privacy and social media, and also, I think, to some degree, advertising and worldview manipulation.
Fair. I'll take that. Sure.
Well, I mean, you did work in the advertising industry, and I think at
I
base.
I also debated the ambassador to Pakistan at the United Nations about this exact topic. So yeah, no, I try not to puff myself up too much. You know, I try to keep my head down and just say, here's a book that was, you know, a quarter of the manuscript is research. If you look at social media's bullshit, 25% of that manuscript is links and interviews and anecdotes and secondary data. The same is true with the privacy book. So I try to put my focus on the program and the product more than me. And so, you know, it's always just funny when people say that. Like, my ears always perk up. I'm like, that's right. I do that, I guess.
Well, in the privacy book, which has a couple different titles, the one that I heard was an audiobook. It was The End of Privacy.
Yes.
You talk a lot about a category of behavior that corporations engage in, which is simultaneously legal and creepy. What do you mean by that?
So again, you know, we were talking about the short memory of the media. I don't know if anyone listening to this will remember, but a few years back, everyone was on the hype train for growth hacking. Does that term sound familiar to you?
Actually, I must have been asleep that day.
Okay, yeah, most people were, but in Silicon Valley and among the tech companies and marketing industry, growth hacking was this huge thing. And basically what it was an elaborate way to cheat, spam, and scam people into signing up for these different tech companies. So you had Airbnb, and who hired a CTO who was on a list of notorious registered spammers, and that's what they did. They spam people by email to get their initial traction. You know, they hacked into Craigslist and abused the platform in a way it wasn't meant to be used in order to get people to sign up on their platform. You know, Instagram was letting you import people from Facebook and Twitter in order to grow quickly, even though your friends had no idea this was happening. LinkedIn was, you know, this one is the most notorious example of LinkedIn was uploading everyone's address book and then spamming them to the point where they had to settle out of court for a multimillion dollar lawsuit. So there was this wave, and it's in truth, it's been going on since 1994, but around 2013, 2014, for whatever reason, there was this wave of growth hacking. And Facebook participated in that too. You know, they purchased an email company overseas in order to get addresses that they can in turn spam to grow their site. A lot of people forget that. You know, we watch The Social Network, but that part of the story isn't in the movie, so we don't talk about it. So yeah, there's nothing illegal up until the spamming part. There's nothing illegal about scrapping people's information. And I'll give you another example. There was a company on Shark Tank. I'm not allowed to say who they were, but they were a young scrappy company on Shark Tank who the story they told on the show was not at all how they actually grew. On the show, they were like, oh, you know, we were scrappy. We spent some money on some advertising in college newspapers, and that's how people signed up. The reality was that most colleges have open directories that you can search to get people's email addresses. So what they did was they built a program to scrape all of the emails from multiple colleges, and then they spam those students, and that's actually how they grew. And so that's what actually got them on Shark Tank, was not the story in the company, it was the technology they built to do it, and that's why they received their investment. And so that stuff isn't necessarily illegal, but it certainly is creepy. And we talked a little bit earlier on the show about your smartphone being the best listening device known to man. And so all that data collection, while not illegal, is certainly creepy, and it's wrong. But we allow it to happen right now. And so this is how tech companies grow. This is the true story of how tech companies become these multi-billion dollar enterprises. It wasn't, oh, look at me, like, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg was saying when I founded Facebook out of my dorm room. You know, he didn't mention that they bought this company overseas that was scraping people's email addresses. They didn't mention some of the other spammy tactics that they were utilizing to grow. He just said, look at poor little me. Starting the company in the dorm room. So there's a lot of like this myth of how we build up these tech companies in our imagination, and there's the reality of doing these, while not illegal, certainly unethical things to grow.
Do you know about the social media platform called Minds?
I do not.
Well, I can't say a whole lot about it because to me the interface is a little bit baffling. But I think it's popular among young right-wingers, and there is a fellow Vermonter. I think he lives up north where most Vermonters live, up around Burlington. But he is a YouTube star. He goes by the handle StixHammer666, and he comments on esoteric and occult literature and also politics and such. And he put out a video a couple weeks back just crowing about the death of Facebook and how glad he was to see it circling the drain. And he mentioned that he can post a new video to Facebook, where he's had an account for many, many years, and he can post it, that exact same link, to Minds.com, which is this alternative crypto-based social media platform. And he's going to get more people clicking through on Minds than he will from Facebook. And so, you know, go ahead.
Well, there's a couple of points there. I'm not terribly political, so I don't want anyone to take this the wrong way, but Fox News is not a news outlet that I would appear on, although we've certainly, you know, there's been a discussion of having me go on Tucker Carlson's to talk about stuff like this, where the right-wing media, for better or worse, seems to think that Facebook is out to get them. They think this is particularly popular among the conservative outlets, where they're convinced that Facebook is actively, like, denying traffic to them. I don't necessarily know if that's true. I can tell you there is certainly bias built into every system. We see that playing out right now with banks and people applying for jobs. where, you know, if you're African-American and, you know, not white, that you could be discriminated against based on the data that's been collected about you. So it's certainly possible the other way, to the other extreme, where if you're posting content that is more Alex Jones than, let's say, Rachel Maddow, then it's entirely possible the algorithm is penalizing you, whereas if you post it to any other place, you get more traffic. So that's been a large point of discussion. I know I don't have a great answer for that as to whether or not it's true. What I can say is that the reason why, if you're a Tucker Carlson or you're this gentleman that we're talking about, and you post on a different social media platform, the reason why you're getting the traffic is simple. It's they're probably not using an algorithm to filter things out. And so if you post something, it's back. I don't know. Again, I'm aging. I'm pointing out how old I am here. Back in the good old days of Dig and Reddit, when you were to post something on the site, everyone would see it. So it, you know, regardless of what it was posted, everyone would have an opportunity to look at it. Whereas most of the popular social media platforms use an algorithm to filter things. So that's why that happens. And I know that that's sort of been their talking point for a while now. And I don't know how to react to it, because on one hand, the conservative media does raise a lot of great points about Facebook that I think, to their credit, in their defense, that the liberal media has not acknowledged for one reason or another. But I don't know if I buy into that conspiracy theory necessarily that they've been putting out there.
Well, I'm sure that Stixhammer666 will never be invited to be on Tucker Carlson. He does all of his... He's got long, pardon me, long, straight, blonde hair. He's a skinny guy with a beard, you know, neatly trimmed beard, but he does all of his videos shirtless, but in a leather jacket.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, but he's got a lot of followers on YouTube. I mean, he's...
Yeah, you know, I give... So, you know, we talked about webcomics and you know, me putting out Vengeance Nevada, and so regardless of what people's political beliefs are, I do give people a lot of credit for sticking to something. I think that's the biggest problem most people fail at. When it comes to promoting a product or anything, it doesn't matter what the product is that no one sticks with it. You know, I have this list of like 10,000 podcasters, and about 4,000 of them abandon their shows. And so to me, it's like, you know, if you just stuck with it long enough, I am convinced that you can break through. I know that, you know, like we were talking about this before the show, where you've been podcasting for a long time, and I've been publishing humor columns for a long time, and sometimes I feel like I'm not quite breaking through, but then I have other days where, you know, I'm talking to you on the air, and I never thought that would be possible back in 2002. I never thought I would be invited to talk at the United Nations about social media. So, you know, for someone like that, where he's just putting out content regardless of what we think of the content, I do give people like that some credit.
And he puts out a lot of content. I do some YouTube videos, but I tend to slave over them and put way too much time into them, and I couldn't possibly put out the amount of content that he does. He just has the one static shot, and he's just on camera and no editing, and just, you know, his Satanism and skinny shirtless self, and something about that works for him.
Well, it sounds like, you know, that's what YouTube is made for, right?
Yeah.
You know, here's the funny thing about YouTube. It's not clear whether or not they're profitable. I think last year was the first time they said that they've actually made money. And that's really interesting because YouTube has been around since 2007. And so their whole claim to fame is that anyone can be famous. But the truth of the matter is the stuff that gets the most views is either pirated or, you know, the people spend a whole lot of money to promote that stuff. And then you've got that 1% that's either spending money or it's stuff from big studios. And then you've got like 99.9% of everyone behind that, where we're just sort of putting content into the wind and no one's really looking at it. But yet YouTube is constantly running around saying, you know, we give everyone a voice. And it's not necessarily the truth.
Well, this is maybe a can of worms I don't want to dive into. But YouTube recently changed their policies to make it even harder for new people, undiscovered voices to break through and find some relevance. And they've also made it, basically they've restricted the ability to make money by advertising on YouTube to people with more than a certain number of followers and more than a certain number of views, which locks out, you know, 99% of the people who are posting content.
Yeah. Where do I start on that one? What's really fascinating to me about it? Is that when they do things like that, they're reacting to things like Logan Paul just being an idiot. basically. And then they're running into their advertisers and going, look at us, we care about brand safety. That's sort of the big buzzword that they throw around. We care about brand safety, therefore these creators can't get the money because, you know, they don't put out content that we feel safe associating your advertising with. And to me, what's frustrating is that you can still easily find terrorist content and propaganda and all sorts of just vile, nasty stuff on YouTube. And to me, like, they're not solving the problem, but somehow they're targeting and penalizing their creators and using that as, look at us, we're solving the problem. Meanwhile, they're not. And again, it goes back to us thinking that the algorithm is magic when it's really just this dumb thing that anyone can manipulate. And that's what you see, is that, you know, people who put out propaganda of any sort know how to manipulate their system and get their content featured along, these big video items. And so it's just frustrating because there's a lot of great YouTube creators out there. For as difficult as it is to make a living on YouTube, as difficult as it is to gain an audience, there's still some great stuff, and they're being penalized because Google doesn't want to go and admit, hey, this stuff isn't magic, it can be easily abused, and we don't want to pay to have it cleaned up. That's what it comes down to. It's Facebook, YouTube, all these platforms don't want to pay people to sit there and moderate it. Zuckerberg told Congress, in the coming years, artificial intelligence will be the thing that helps prevent things like Russia from happening. And I was thinking, no, man, it's just going to make it easier, if anything else, because big data can be really stupid. You just don't want to hire people to do the job and police your site.
Artificial intelligence is a huge topic. People who work in artificial intelligence or in the research community around it, there's a joke, and you mentioned a version of this in your book. It's artificial intelligence is all the things that computers can't do yet. And as soon as they can do something like, you know, voice recognition or beating humans at chess or beating the world grandmaster at chess or Go or whatever, or beating, you know, what was the champion of Go yesterday, which was a computer with another computer. Well, suddenly these tasks, which used to be outside of the realm of things that can be automated, are no longer considered to be artificial intelligence.
That's right.
But you gave a sort of different take on that in the book. What was that?
Yeah, so the joke that I've encountered in interviewing people in the artificial intelligence community is that artificial intelligence refers to things that just haven't been invented yet, and everything else gets a name. So really, when you hear Zuckerberg or the other tech company executives talk about artificial intelligence, they're really talking about machine learning. And all that is just, you know, the system knows what it knows, and that's why you hear these stories about computers being really good at Go, but not being so good at driving, because we think that, how do I explain it? So it's basically that these data, it only knows what you tell it, and therefore, like, something like Go only has a certain number of outcomes. There's maybe millions of possibilities, but that's it. There's those million possibilities, and that's all it could do, whereas when you're driving or doing something like policing a site for content, there's all these other factors that it can control for. And so for them to say artificial intelligence is the thing that's going to fix it, it's just a flat-out lie. Like, it's just preying on us not knowing any better and not realizing the old term garbage in, garbage out for computers, and it only knows what you tell it. So because we think it's magic, that's an acceptable answer, but I really don't think it should be.
At the same time, though, I mean, computers and automated systems are gaining ground, basically taking over tasks which used to require an organic human intelligence to accomplish, and it no longer does. And the benefits of that incremental creep are not being equally distributed in society, so that the people losing out, you know, losing employment opportunities to machines are not being compensated for that.
Yeah, so there's this point that dates back to 2007, but it was popularized by Jerome Lanier in his 2011 book, where he said, you know, you might think that using something like Facebook is free, but the reality is you're feeding it data. So, you know, I'm joking and saying garbage in, garbage out, but, you know, every day we create a whole new data set for Facebook that can be packaged and sold to artificial intelligence companies and could lead to a lot of jobs being automated. So even though the computer only knows what it knows, it knows a lot. So, yes, it could certainly lead to a lot of unemployment. And the point I make in the book is that data shouldn't be free to give Facebook. You know, it shouldn't be, they shouldn't be the only beneficiary of all of this data. If it's going to lead to me losing a job in the ad industry because you can automate someone selecting the platform to place advertisements on and the kind of advertisements are going to run, I should be compensated for that data so that I can learn a new skill set, you know, whether that's augmented reality or maybe it's something with machine learning. Regardless of what that thing should be, the data should not be free for you to go and package billions off of. It should be something that I'm compensated for because ultimately it's my data, I created it. And the line I use in the book is, it's your data, your choice.
I've talked to people before about the idea that the social media platforms and other corporate entities which make use of our data should pay us for it. And the sort of perverse nature of that proposal is that the people whose data is worth the most money to the corporations are the people who need, you know, to be paid by those corporations the least. Basically, somebody who can afford to take a vacation, you know, in Europe or, you know, in Bali or whatever, their data, their browsing habits, their movements, their preferences is worth a whole lot more money than, you know, the information that tells advertisers that I don't have anything to spend and that I don't leave my apartment all that much. And when I do, I'm going to work. You know, so my data is just not worth nearly as much as somebody who has a lot more money to spend.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I found that's the debate that I get into with people from Europe. So I found when I talk about you should be compensated for your data, everyone in the United States goes, yes, of course, let's do it. Why would I not take this free money? And then on the other side of the pond, the response is, yeah, but the data from one person is not necessarily what you would pay someone else. And then, you know, should we even be, what's that mean that we're paying people for our privacy? And so there is very much a larger debate as to, well, should we be compensated, and if so, how much? And then, really, why should we be compensated in the first place? Because we're giving away what is often described as a human right. And so, I don't have an answer to that. You know, I it's something that I wanted to start the discussion of. That's really the point of the book, was to lay out the facts of what I see happening, and then have people that are far, far smarter than me to go and have that discussion as to if I get paid, this is how much, or if you get paid at all. Or what the repercussions should be. So something that's come up, for example, is Apple, Facebook, Amazon. They don't pay their taxes, and so one of the ideas that's come up is that, okay, well, you could pay people for their data, sure. I think that's a great idea, but why don't you just have them pay their taxes and use that money to give people employee education? So the $289 billion or whatever it is that Apple is sitting on and pretending that they pay, let's use that to retrain people, and therefore you don't have to pay people for the data. So to me, it's a fascinating conversation. I don't have all the answers on it, but the fact that we're talking about this is incredible, because going back to when Lanier put out his book and going back to when Sig was debating this topic, it didn't really get a lot of traction outside of Silicon Valley. You know, it was one of those things where it's like, that's nice, I'm going to go and do something else. But now here we are on the radio talking about compensation for your data and whether or not it's a social justice issue or it's a human rights issue, and that to me is really what I wanted to have happen with the book.
Well, let me just say, I love terrestrial radio and I love this radio station, but you're on community radio in rural Vermont. So don't put too much stake in that.
Well, no, but here's the thing. The fact that it's discussion is happening, and then, you know, I'll share the discussion with other people, the fact that we, you know, regardless of where the message is broadcast from, the message is getting out there. And so I'm a big believer that every person counts. You know, I come from a background of word-of-mouth marketing. I've made most of my success in the marketing advertising world through word-of-mouth. I mean, I have no budget for my books. You know, Social Media's Bullshit sold 7,000 copies purely through luck and grit and word-of-mouth. And, you know, the privacy books with the different titles, if people go to yourprivacybook.com, they can purchase either version. That's all through word of mouth. And so I very much believe that if I can empower one person, I've done my job. And so it's sort of like the old George Carlin routine where he talks about a person is smart and intelligent and kind and reasonable, and people are really stupid. And so if I can reach a person that's listening to this, if I can reach 10 people that's listening to this, and then I'm doing my job, because those 10 people will then ideally tell the next 10 people. And so it doesn't matter where the message is from, as long as it's getting out there.
So what's the website again?
It's yourprivacybook.com is where people can purchase either version.
All righty, yourprivacybook.com.
That's right. And one thing I mentioned earlier, I give away my cell phone number Because that's how I tell people to contact me. If they like what I have to say or if they hate what I have to say, you can email me at bj@bjmendelson.com or you can text me at 646-331-8341. And if you text me the word sheetrock, which is spelled exactly as it sounds, sheetrock, I will send you a free PDF of Social Media is Bullshit. So the number is 646-331-8341, and you can get a free book if you text me.
Wow. I will not be giving out my cell phone number because every time that thing buzzes, it breaks my concentration. So try to make it buzz as little as possible.
Understandably, and I think that's ultimately the goal for everyone, right?
I don't know. I'm increasingly convinced that I am disconnected from the things that most people think of are relevant and important, because it just, when I look at the media sphere and the conversations that take place in the mainstream outlets, I am bewildered.
Yeah, but I feel like the nice thing, you know, I mentioned in the statistic that about 80 to 85% of millennials, even though I don't quite identify with that group, own a smartphone. And one of the refreshing things that I do see happening is people are putting down their phone less, you know, they're not taking it into their bedroom. They're deleting apps that are just sort of sitting there. So I'm convinced you have it right. And, you know, over time, over the next 10 years, since everyone is now at a saturation point with these smartphones, I think we're going to use them less and less. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed on that.
Hey, let's talk practicalities for a moment.
Sure.
In the beginning of the audiobook, you go through a lot of different things that people can do to protect their privacy. And I did, after listening to that, install Privacy Badger.
Great.
Yeah, I'm not using Tor.
Most people don't.
Yeah. Much as I've thought about, you know, maybe, well, this is a few years out of date now, but getting on Silk Road and, you know,
right.
doing a little shopping, a little pharmaceutical shopping.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not doing that, but I did install Privacy Badger. What's the low-hanging fruit in terms of protecting your privacy?
So, the three easy ones that I tell everyone that you can do, like, right now is put tape over your laptop camera, or really any camera that's connected to an Internet of Things device. You know, if it has an Internet connection and a camera, you should cover it, basically. So that's the simplest thing. And that's not paranoia. That's something that, you know, Edward Snowden talked about. It's something that Mark Zuckerberg notoriously is photographed with tape over his camera. So, you know, if even he's doing it, then maybe the rest of us should follow suit. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that you should keep all of your passwords offline in a notebook and not anywhere online. I know it sounds a little prehistoric, but that's the safest way to have your passwords anywhere. And
what, not in a folder in your Gmail inbox?
Yeah, that's right. Or infamously, like Sony, where they had a folder on a desktop that was just called passwords. So, yeah, don't do that. But do use a notebook and make sure the third thing is make sure you update your passwords once a year. And if you're the victim of a data leak, which most of us are these days, so you should actively change your password when necessary.
So what about passwords? How long, if you've been using the same password for 5 years, are you really walking on thin ice?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, if you look at, if anyone out there, of the billions of people that have a Yahoo account, your information has been leaked. If you have a Experian or Equifax account, you've been leaked. If you are a part of SunTrust just this week, you know, your data is out there. So if you have a password that's over 5 years old, you should absolutely go and change it. And one other thing I want to add, and most platforms these days have two-factor authentication. It's very easy to turn on. It's in the settings. All that means is that when you log into Twitter, let's say, you'll get a text saying, hey, enter this code just to confirm that it's you. And that is wonderful. I really recommend everyone activate that if at all possible.
Well, let me throw in a caveat on that. That's great for you people who live in the city.
Yes.
If you live someplace where cell phone reception is spotty, that can be a real pain in the ass.
Yes. That's absolutely true. It's not perfect, and none of these things are perfect. I mean, if you put something in a notebook, and let's say you live in a family like I do where there's six kids and a bunch of adults, you know, no one's to say that they're not going to take the notebook and log into all your stuff. So, I mean, there's certainly drawbacks like that, that's true. I've lived in places where that's certainly been the case. But if you do have decent reception, I do recommend it.
So we have been exploring the contents of your books basically through the filter of my interests, but are there places that we should go that I haven't thought to take us?
No, I think that your interests really are everyone's interests. I think that that's, I think it's important that people understand, you know, again, that this stuff isn't magic and that there really is a larger debate that's about to take place, which you touched on, about compensating people for their data and what does that mean from a social justice and human rights issue. And we really haven't touched on it, but there's also issues of the data being used against you if you're applying for a job or looking for a loan. That are things that are now actively being explored and written about. So I think your interest accurately reflects what everyone's talking about. So I think it's been great.
If I'd been thinking ahead, I would have queued up a clip from an episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation. It was an episode called The Drumhead, where Picard is put on trial by this sort of witch-hunting prosecutor, and he has a conversation with Worf. It's one of those, you know, little philosophical asides on Star Trek, where Worf says, you know, people who have nothing to hide should not fear this investigation.
Yeah.
And Picard has a very, you know, eloquent response to that. What's your maybe not quite Patrick Stewart level response to the, hey, I'm not doing anything wrong. What do I care?
I've always been a Deep Space Nine guy, so I don't know if Commander Sisko would agree with me or not, but I always tell people, I quote Glenn Greenwald, who said, if you have nothing to hide, give me your password. You know, let me log into your stuff. And then I always take it a little further because I've worked on apps where I knew right down to where in the house someone was. Like, I knew if they were in the bathroom, and so I would say, okay, give me your passwords and let me follow you into the bathroom if you've got nothing to hide. So everyone, it's not necessarily that you have something to hide, but you might have something that might reflect on you poorly, or, you know, if you're in my case where, you know, your family might have one opinion about something and you don't necessarily want them to know about something else, you know, that's information that while you're not trying to actively hide it, you don't necessarily want to share. And so we do all have information we don't necessarily want to share in one context or another. And so it's important that you have some kind of barrier to protect yourself.
I have been talking with BJ Mendelsohn, who is the author of multiple books on privacy and social media. And we're just about out of time, and I need to talk about a couple of things that are relevant to the local audience, but maybe you can help me out with this.
Sure,
have you
thanks.
Seen Ready Player One?
Yes, I have.
What'd you think?
I like the book better.
I like the book better, too, but I saw Ready Player One last night at the Bellows Falls Opera House movie theater, where all movie tickets are $5, regardless of which show.
Wow.
We have a communist movie theater here. It is subsidized by the town.
I love it.
Yeah, I love it, too. I absolutely do. So it's still playing there. You could go see it, not you, because it'd be quite a drive, or a train ride, a nice one, but, you know, you've seen it anyway. But anybody in this area can easily make their way to the Bellows Falls Opera House movie theater and for a very reasonable price see this visual spectacular, you know, spectacle of a movie. And it's, I really enjoyed it, and I loved the book.
And the visuals are great too. I mean, there's a sequence involving King Kong. I don't want to give too much away, but there's that sequence with King Kong which is worth the $5 admission.
Yes, and you know, I think spoilers are irrelevant with this thing. It is such just, you know, it's just all flash and beautiful CGI and amazingly, you know, integrated digital and real performances by the actors. It's really something special.
I thought, you know, I was highly entertained. I always prefer the book to the movie, but you can't go wrong. At that price point, you should absolutely go and spend an old easy Sunday there and see it.
I think the one instance that I can think of where the movie was better than the book was Fight Club.
Yes.
It took big patch, you know, big stretches directly from the novel, so that helps, you know. A lot of go ahead.
I think Fight Club hasn't aged well. Honestly, you know, I definitely agree with you. I don't think Fight Club, the book or the movie, has aged very well since 9/11 in particular. But yes, I do think that the movie will live longer than the book for that reason, where they kind of streamlined it to a place where it's a fascinating character study, for one thing. So regardless of what you think about Project Mayhem and what they're doing, that stuff is endlessly fascinating. And I think the movie does a better job of displaying that than the book.
And this next thing, I don't think I can make quite as conversational, but in this very building from which I am speaking to you, the 33 Bridge Street building on the island here in Bellows Falls, tonight there is going to be an open mic event that has a theme. And the theme is, if you didn't memorize everything that I just said, it can all be found at blacksheepradio.org. All right, BJ Middleton, this has been a bunch of fun. I hope it is not our last conversation. And let me just encourage you to give your book titles and website information once more.
Sure. Both versions of the book can be found at yourprivacybook.com. I highly recommend the audio version if you like jokes. And if you don't like jokes, you can get yourself the print version.
I like
jokes.
And
if you want to learn more about me, I'm at bjmendelson.com. And for those of you who would like a free PDF copy of Social Media is Bullshit, all you have to do is text me at 646-331-8341. And I'll send one right over.
All right. Well, hey, BJ, I've had fun. Thank you for calling. I hope to talk to you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
On the Sea Realm podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back,
never go back
to
never
its go old back. Dimensions.
All right, that was BJ Mendelson. And even though I left in the Black Sheep Radio WOOL Sea Realm Radio bumper in the middle, you are actually listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Thanks for that. You know, I have been doing this podcast since October of 2006. That is a long, long time. And if I had known that 12 years after I started, my audience size would be probably about the same as it was 2 years into the project, I'm not sure I would have stuck with it. But I'm glad I did. Maybe you can help me remember. There's some author, or maybe it was a presenter at a TED Talk, or I heard somewhere, somebody. Now that I think about it, maybe it was somebody whose name is very difficult for me to pronounce. I think it's something like Maje Sagosque. Sorry, sir, for mispronouncing your name so horribly. Maybe somebody can send me the correct pronunciation. But whoever it was said, human life is only long enough for you to fail at something for 20 years with just, you know, one or two projects. And of course, failure is conditional on your definition. The fact that I have done the Sea Realm podcast for this long has brought me into contact with a number of extraordinary people that I would not have met had I been doing something else. For example, Kevin Lin, who has been a guest in this program and who is, I'm not sure his exact title, but he is the Grand Poobah at the Center for Progressive Urban Politics. He has now hired me to do a weekly comic strip for that website. So it's Center for Progressive Urban Politics, or cfpup.org, and the name of the comic is Terra Inferma. So there is a Terra Inferma tab at the cfpup.org website. If you haven't already done so, I would invite you to check it out. And remember that we post a new strip every Sunday. You know, the feedback that I get most often on the comic is that people like the look of it. They like the drawings. And I'm glad they do, because I spend a whole lot of time working on them. And if you're interested, you can see the comic as it takes shape. You can see preliminary sketches and pieces of upcoming strips on my Patreon page. It's patreon.com/KMO. You can subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast there for just $7 a month, and people who donate a dollar or more can see all of the behind-the-scenes material that I post about the comic strip production process. I also post the occasional essay there. Two things I wish I'd gotten involved with as soon as I learned of their existence are Bitcoin and Patreon. Both of them were on my radar for a very long time before I did anything about them. Of course, if you have any feedback on the comic strip or on this podcast, I would love to hear it. My email address, or I guess read it more likely, my email address is kmo@crealm.com. That's the letter C as in consciousness, and then a dash, and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. Or you can interact with other Sea Realm listeners on Facebook. Yeah, Facebook. There is a group there called Friends of the Sea Realm. I don't participate there as much as I used to, and that is intentional. I'm giving the Facebook monster much less of my time than I used to. And in particular, I'm not arguing with people there. I am not stepping into the gladiatorial arena of Facebook to defend my worldview, to act as champion for a particular belief system, or as Robert Anton Wilson called it, a reality tunnel. And speaking of reality tunnels and consciousness and Robert Anton Wilson, to me, this is a category of topics that leads right into the idea of changing one's consciousness via the use of psychedelics. And for those of you who have been listening to the podcast for a very long time, you know that the Sea Realm audience is an odd mix of people who are interested in psychedelics and people who are interested in the idea of the collapse of industrial civilization, probably because of a shortfall of the fossil fuels that are the basic energy input into this society and which allows for the maintenance of such amazing social and technological complexity. Well, I haven't had much to say on the topic of psychedelics in a very long time. There are many reasons for that. I won't go into them here. If you're interested, let me know, and maybe I'll talk about it on a future podcast. But the topic, I think, is going to come roaring back into my head because of a new book that's coming out in May from Michael Pollan. Michael Pollan, the author of such books as The Botany of Desire, A Place of My Own, Second Nature, A Gardener's Education, and more recently, books on food like Cooked. I absolutely love to read Michael Pollan's books, and I will surely be reading his upcoming book. It's called How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. That comes out May 15th, 2018. And I will definitely be getting that one in hardcover. Well, there are so many great podcasts to listen to now. I know that you've got a really great one queued up to go after this one, so I won't take up any more of your time. I will just say thank you very much for listening to the Sea Realm Podcast, given the vast universe of podcast possibilities that are available to you now. I hope that you will join me again for another Sea Realm conversation, and until you next hear my voice, I do hope that you will stay well.